headlines, a senior Hamas official describes Israel as a threat to humanity, saying the regime has failed to be recognized as a legitimate entity by free nations. A new report says most Americans are frustrated with skyrocketing prices in the housing sector, which has made many people unable to buy a home. A UN tourism body suspends Russia's membership as the West mounts diplomatic pressure on Moscow over its military operation in Ukraine. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. A senior representative of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in Lebanon says the Palestinian cause is a humanitarian one, connecting all free nations. Osama Hamadan also described the Israeli regime as a threat to humanity.
First of all, let's say that the issue of Palestine, the Palestinian cause, Palestinian question, Al-Quds, is a humanitarian cause and not only a Palestinian Arab Muslim cause. But the most significant message is that this enemy, this occupation force, is not only against the Palestinians alone, but is also against the entire, all of humanity.
Hamdan further highlighted the importance of International Quds Day, introduced by the founder of Iran's Islamic Republic in the fight against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He says the regime has failed to be recognized as a legitimate entity by free nations, despite its decades of relentless efforts. He called Israel a usurper regime, which is seeking its hegemony across the region. Hamadan also underlined that the recent Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque were aimed at weakening Palestinian resistance against the regime.
This enemy does not believe, only believes in the language of force and excessive force and violence. And they believe that they need to be, in order to take control of the certain hegemony and certain land, they need to break the will and the determination of the people. They've tried and attempted different ways and different methods.
Hamadan also noted portraying itself as an invincible entity as part of the regime's tactic to make resistance forces believe that it cannot be defeated, but he said such tactics are futile as the Israeli regime is afraid of resistance groups both in Palestine and Lebanon. Hamadan also referred to pro-Israeli propaganda by mainstream Western media. He said the world knows well about the plight of Palestinians, no matter some media turn a blind eye to the facts. Meanwhile, Hamas representative in Lebanon painted a grim picture of the people in the Gaza Strip. He said 60% of Gazans are below poverty line, and the situation is exacerbating in the continent because of the Israeli siege. Iran's foreign minister says holding the International Quds Day ceremony is a major step to counter Zionist regime's plots against Muslims. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with Iraq's new parliament speaker, Mohammad al-Halbousi. He said that the Zionist regime is a source of threat to the entire region. Iran's top diplomat also reiterated Tehran's support for the political process in Iraq, saying a strong Iraq guarantees regional peace and security. He added that Iran backs Iraq's stability, considering the security of Iraq as its own and vice versa. Amir Abdullahian also had a phone conversation with his Malaysian counterpart. He said the Organization of Islamic Cooperation's Special Committee must discuss the issue of Palestine at a foreign ministerial level. Amir Abdullahian reiterated Iran's categorical opposition to the normalization of some Arab states' relations with Israel. With the International Quds Day being around the corner, resistance groups have held a conference in the Lebanese capital to voice their solidarity with Palestinians. They called on Muslims to maintain unity, supporting Al-Quds in the face of Israeli aggression. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
Just ahead of International Quds Day, support for Palestinians is gaining momentum across Lebanon. The seminar was held in the Lebanese capital, where the speakers touched upon the significance of the Quds Day.
The
significance of this holiday is that Imam Khomeini,
called on the free people of the world, and the Muslims of the world, and the Christians of the world, to look at this historic, religious, and national enemy, which wants to steal your sanctities and Judaize your city and bury your heritage. Be cautious on this threat and be united to face this aggressive enemy.
With the violent Israeli crackdown against the people of the Holy City in Palestine, activists say the sacrifices of the Palestinians will be fruitful, and that Al-Quds is an occasion for Muslims to stand united in supporting the Palestinian cause.
Samahat al-Imam.
Imam Khomeini considered that an Arab and Islamic identity is incomplete without liberating Al-Quds. Therefore, this is a shame for those who continue to normalize ties with this enemy that continues to launch the most heinous assaults with their artillery and bullets. Thousands of wounded people have lost their eyesight, and many of them lost one eye or two. Hundreds of wounded people fell in the past assault. We will eventually pray in Al-Quds, no matter how long it takes.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General also stressed that Al-Quds is not merely a piece of land. It is rather an international humane cause. And Imam Khomeini established a cultural, ethical, and religious system to liberate it.
Mizatul Imam.
Imam Khomeini did not only make a declaration, he put a roadmap for the liberation of Palestine. He did not only call on the people to hold commemorations and events and make speeches to celebrate a day for Al-Quds, he directly closed the Israeli embassy and opened the Palestinian embassy. He founded Al-Quds Brigade as part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which would begin to form the army of 20 million. This would extend to the rest of the region and would support resistance inside Palestine. The only objective is to liberate Palestine.
All the speakers at the conference agree that those who believe in the Palestinian cause are convinced more than ever that Al-Quds in Palestine will be liberated. International Quds Day has developed from being a day of solidarity and vocal support to being a day of practical coordination between the resistance factions. The Resistance Alliance has for once ratified a unified strategy of defense, and the focal point is Al-Quds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is compounded by violent crackdown, have been fiercely slammed by Muslims worldwide, but some Arab states normalize their ties with the regime under a U.S.-brokered deal, deliberately ignoring Israel's crimes. The agreement sparked an outcry, with Palestinians calling it a stab in the back. We've talked to a number of people in different countries to get their views on the normalization of deals with the Israeli regime.
Rouhani helped us, Qatar, to normalize the relation with this illegal entity, government of occupiers. That's the Zionist regime of Israel. Those people are shameless people. Those leaders are very irresponsible. Those leaders are not representing even 1% of the population of their citizens. They were put there, they were put in place by the countries that want to control the whole world and the Arab nation.
The normalization between Israel and some Arab countries, especially in the Gulf area, it is considered a green light for Israel to continue its occupation practices. Palestinians consider these sorts of obvious or hidden normalizations as a backup for the occupation forces. It is a stab in the back. It makes Palestinians feel that, unfortunately, they are being squeezed into the corner to face this brutality and cruelty at the hands of Israel, which claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East.
Like Islam gives us the values that always stand with the people, stand with the victims. The Quran and the Islam and the last prophet, as Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, also told us to stand with the victims. But the problem is that the Islamic leaders, especially the Arab countries, they are not even they are supporting Palestinians, but indirectly they are supporting the Israelis. So if they are not condemning, or they are just saying that it's not good, this is not enough. You have to take the decision. You are the leaders, you have resources, you have population, you are the representatives of Muslim. So it's your responsibility to stand with Palestinians. It's not enough to just condemn. And even it's really horrible that few countries, they are not even condemning. just for the sake of maybe for the good book of America, for the good book of Israel. It's really alarming for all of the people, especially for Muslims.
An apartheid regime anywhere in the world is against people's conscience, for those that have conscience, because it thrives on dehumanization as well as brutalization. And that is exactly what we are seeing. So for the Arab countries, some of those that are normalizing relations with Israel, is a clear message to the people of Palestine that they are on their own and that they can't enjoy any support.
The relationship is not leading to peace. It's not heading towards peace. It is a betrayal of the cause of the Palestinian people.
Diversi regimi arabi, da una parte, grazie a Dio, hanno tolto la loro maschera che già era, diciamo, del loro sul loro vero volto. Dall'altro hanno dimostrato questa collaborazione che già da anni esisteva sotto banco con il regime israeliano e pertanto hanno in qualche modo palesato questi atti di tradimento che hanno commesso da già decenni nei confronti del popolo palestinese.
Most home buyers in the United States are frustrated with soaring prices in the housing sector, which put properties out of reach for many of them. Real estate agencies and customers say home sale prices are 4 to 5% above the initial asking level in most regions, making it impossible for many Americans to own a house. The problem has been compounded by a surge in borrowing rates. The interest charged on a 30-year fixed-rate loan has risen to over 5%, the highest level since 2010. Compared to an average of about 3% last year, house supplies were already tight when sales took off during the coronavirus pandemic, but builders have failed to keep up amid a shortage of workers and global supply chain problems, which have pushed housing prices even higher. To discuss that further, we're joined by Jack Rasmus, professor of political economy from St. Mary's College. Thank you very much, Professor. If you could please shed more light on the different aspects of this housing crisis that people are facing in the United States.
Well, the housing crisis is not new. It's been with us for some time. It's just deteriorating. It's getting worse. Prices, of course, are going up for a number of reasons. Some of them are supply reasons, materials and so forth. Some of it is due to the rising interest rates, which interest rates for materials and construction costs and so forth are just passed on into the price of the house, which keeps rising. The U.S. has not been building enough home units, housing units, for median and below people, mostly just high-end, mostly new housing. The demand, of course, when you have such a short supply, it drives up the price even more. So it's a supply problem. It's also a demand problem. It's also the Federal Reserve's interest rates problem. And we already see in the last month or so a significant decline in new housing construction and purchases. And this is going to only get worse here going forward very, very shortly. It's already deteriorating. So inflation in housing is going to remain with us for some time and get worse. And the problem is the more that housing prices go up, the more rents go up. That has an effect of dragging up rents, and far more people are renting. About 50 million people are renters in this country, or rental units, 50 million rental units, maybe 100 million people. So they are being squeezed even more, I would say, than new home buyers. You have the phenomenon of foreign buyers sending their money to the U.S. and purchasing high-end homes and so forth, particularly on the coasts, but now even inland, and of course that drives it up. In certain places you have a problem with people doing very well in the stock market, cashing in their gains and buying homes. You have the phenomenon of remote work going on, and people are trying to get out of the big cities who can't afford it and buying up homes in the suburbs and slightly beyond the suburbs. So all these factors come together, and it's like a perfect storm of inflation and lack of affordability. And the more you raise rates, Stephen, less affordable it gets, which means people who can't buy homes will rent, and that'll drive rent prices up even further. So it's a vicious cycle.
Thank you very much, Jack Erasmus, professor of political economy from St. Mary's College, San Francisco. The West is mounting diplomatic pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Now the UN tourism body is suspending Russia's membership, arguing that it has breached its statute. Most members of the UN World Tourism Organization backed the move at an extraordinary session of its General Assembly. The motion was proposed by over 20 member states in March. The new development came after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. Meanwhile, Canadian lawmakers have voted to call Russia's operation in Ukraine, quote, a genocide, saying there was ample evidence to uphold the designation. U.S. President Joe Biden had already called Russia's military operation a genocide. Canada is among the countries that have imposed sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Ukraine's defense minister warns that Russia's developing offensive in the east will lead to, quote, destruction and painful casualties. He says that Russia has already gathered its forces for a large-scale offensive in eastern Ukraine. The minister says his country faces, quote, extremely difficult weeks as Russia's new offensive looms. Moscow has shifted its focus to the east and south of Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors enters its third month. Russia has captured several villages in eastern Ukraine as it seeks to take full control of the Donbass region.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A whistleblower working on Britain's Homes for Ukraine scheme has revealed that he and his colleagues
don't know what we're doing, and says the scheme has been designed to fail in order to manage numbers entering the United Kingdom. We're prepared for you an article written by Mark Townsend. The piece is titled, Homes for Ukraine Whistleblower Says UK Refugee Scheme is Designed to Fail. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Whistleblower working on Britain's Homes for Ukraine scheme has revealed that he and his colleagues don't know what we're doing, and says the scheme has been designed to fail in order to manage numbers entering the United Kingdom. Amid criticism over the numbers of Ukrainians so far allowed to come to Britain, the insider revealed that confusion, poor morale and lack of guidance meant staff contracted to the scheme frequently resorted to making up their response to cases. Staff working on the helpline for the scheme, introduced after widespread fury over the British government's initial response to the Ukrainian refugee crisis, revealed that they received only 3 hours of training with no follow-up help, and said any complaint or suggestion to improve the system was met with silence. The source, who works for the private company responsible for processing the documentation of Ukrainian refugees, said, "We don't really know what we're doing. The system is designed, it would appear, for people to fail. They want to keep the numbers down. Everything they do feels as if it is to do that. I've even had a barrister and lawyers on the phone saying they couldn't understand the system." The whistleblower questioned the official government data on Ukrainian refugees, saying the statistics gave the impression that ministers were being more generous than they were in reality. The source, speaking on condition of anonymity, said he had dealt with numerous cases where UK visas had been issued for an entire Ukrainian family apart from one child, which in effect stopped the family travelling to Britain. The source said this allows the government to say we've issued lots of visas, yet because they have withheld one, it's a guarantee those Ukrainians won't travel to Britain. The whistleblower said he came across 4 or 5 cases each day in which a single child from a family had not received permission to travel, a pattern he believed was too much of a coincidence for it not to have been encouraged. A government source said that family applications were normally processed together, but cases differed in complexity and that safeguarding processes were in place to protect children from trafficking. Latest British government figures show that 40,000 UK visas have been issued under the Homes for Ukraine scheme since it was launched 5 weeks ago, yet just 6,600 Ukrainians have actually arrived in Britain. One sponsor who offered a place in her home for a mother and daughter from Brodyanka in Ukraine, a small town north of Kiev, told The Guardian the child had still not received their visa after a month. Katerina Lysenkova, who is also a volunteer helping Ukrainians come to Britain, said they had applied for a visa for the pair, the mother and daughter, on 21st of March. And although the mother received her visa quickly, the daughter had not, and both had been stranded in Poland. Hours after The Guardian raised the case with the government recently, the daughter received permission to travel to Britain. On Saturday, 23rd of April, British sponsors described being at their wits' end after a Ukrainian mother who was due to stay in their home received a visa, but her children, including a 4-year-old daughter, were left waiting. Katerina Lysenkova said she was aware of 700 applications under the Homes for Ukraine scheme that had still not received a response, many dating from when the scheme was launched. The whistleblower is employed by a Paris-based multinational called Teleperformance, which also owns consular services company TLS Contact. The latter has been criticized for promoting paid services to Ukrainians applying for visas. The source, who has been working on the scheme's hotline for a month, said, "So far, I have had 2 phone calls from Ukrainian women in tears who say that their experiences have left them feeling that they won't be welcomed by the British government and therefore they don't want to come to Britain anymore." That's tough when you hear that. He said that phone calls from potential sponsors and applicants to the Homes for Ukraine scheme rarely appear to be recorded. The source said, "I've taken 1 phone call since I've been here out of hundreds, possibly thousands of phone calls, in which it said recording before the person came through," adding, "I used to work on the COVID-119 lines where everything was recorded." The source noted that the COVID phone line was far more structured. There was a very fixed set of rules with lots of information for us. On the Ukrainian phone line, however, we have no information. However, he said, Teleperformance was not entirely to blame for the problems relating to the Ukrainian scheme, because the firm was essentially working to the specifications provided to them by the British government. Teleperformance is the client. It is just fulfilling whatever it is that's asked of them. But he said any complaints to the firm's management appeared to be ignored. "We got 0 response, and if there is an attempt to tweak it or make it better, we're certainly not told about it. Communication is non-existent." The source said the resultant sentiment among staff was simply frustration. He added, "Colleagues I've spoken to feel the same way. We're all feeling pretty exasperated." The scheme's helpline aims to guide applicants through the sponsor process and help them with inputting the data required for a successful outcome. However, the British government has the final say who gets a visa and is allowed to enter the United Kingdom. A British government spokesperson said that when combined with its Ukraine family scheme, a total of 71,800 visas had been granted to Ukrainians, with 21,600 Ukrainians arriving in Britain. They claimed, "We are processing thousands of visas every day. This shows that the changes we made to streamline the service are working, and we will continue to build on this success so we can speed up the process even further."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, welcome to your own program, A Muslim Lady, where we have been discussing so many various important issues regarding Muslim lady. I hope you have enjoyed all our discussions, and I also hope you will benefit from today's discussions. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me In our studios, my wife, Raldia Batul Najafi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The Muslim society is truly expecting from a truly Muslim lady to be extremely and very nicely, very extremely means modestly and moderately active in a society too, means very productive. And her role in politics and in sciences and everything should be based with knowledge, with wisdom. Maybe you can't believe it, Mr. Masumi, that we have some sayings and ahadith which says in the time of reappearance, when our final imam will come, the level of wisdom and knowledge and the level of advance in science, especially for women, would be so high that every woman somehow would be able to decide, to take decision according to the teaching of Quran and Ahlul Bayt. Like, you know, nowadays we say, oh, she is faqiha, she is alima, like she's so learned, she knows about her responsibilities, her rulings, you know, she's not ignorant, she knows everything, she knows Quran, she has hold on all this divine, you know, knowledge and books. So that kind of person has a very good status. So when the final imam will come, you know, this is the expectation which even now in major occultation Islam and Muslim society has from women, that me as a Muslim member of the society, I have to know, I have to have a very bright and full of wisdom lifestyle. If you have something to please share, otherwise I will give you some examples.
Definitely, when we talk about the reappearance of our last imam, Imam Mahdi, jalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, definitely there are a lot of ahadith which speak about the role of Muslim women in the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, jalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif.
Beautiful. You know, like from 313, how many? How many of them are women? 50. 313 companions, not companions, the ministers.
Such an amazing thing.
Yeah, the ministers.
Because 313, these will be the commanders and the leaders. You know,
So the leadership you can see in women.
So 50 women will be amongst the commanders of Imam Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala.
Beautiful, beautiful. And that is the expectation, yeah? And we have to
prepare.
This is
the true role a Muslim lady can play. It shows the great respect our Islam has given to ladies.
And you can't believe it, like these three ladies, Lady Hakima, the daughter of Imam Jawad, Lady Hamida, the mother of Imam Kazim, and also one more lady, her name is Lady Hudaysa, the grandmother of Imam Zaman, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. These three ladies also played a very political, very active role for the major occultation, for Imam Mahdi to go behind the curtain, and they were somehow playing this role, some of them as a wasi and a successor.
Representative.
Yeah, representative of Imam of the time.
Yeah.
You know, like their duty was so crucial and very, very vital because
keeping in mind the situation of that time, it was very, very, you know, dangerous and tough.
Critical.
To reach to Imam or to, you know, spread his message.
Mm.
So we are going to have a short break. Please, listeners, don't go away. Stay tuned. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, she was the representative of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you know. So, you know, what it shows that as a woman, she has that ability to reach to that level. But there's no need, you know? There's no need in society. There's no need when man is there. But when it comes to such a very, very critical situation and circumstances, like when Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he has to be saved. When Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, you know, his life is in danger. So that, you know, that moments, we can see that the status and the role of a woman, especially in politics, become very highlighted.
Definitely, when we study the history of all our a'imma, the 12 imams from Imam Ali till Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, there are so many women, they have played so many vital roles as a representative, as a leader, as a messenger, as a, you know, a social worker. So it shows that Islam, especially the Shi'i Islam, is paying so much attention towards the progress of women, you know, mentally, health-wise, and physically, socially.
And not only that, like, she should be a great supporter for her family, you know, mentally, especially psychologically and emotionally. She can support her husband, you know, especially emotionally. And I remember this amazing saying about Lady Khadijat al-Kubra, salamullahi alayha, that kana yaskunu ilayha. Like, our Prophet used to get so much peace, you know, mental peace by Lady Khadija, salamullahi alayha.
Spending time with her.
And not only that, he, it means our Prophet, he used to take some suggestions, some ideas from Lady Khadijat al-Kubra, salamullahi alayha. So, you know, her role, yeah, independently is there. Like Lady Umm Salma, one of the wife of our Prophet, also history has written her amazing suggestions towards Rasulullah. And Rasulullah, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, is just listening to her and applying to her suggestions. So we have many evidence and many beautiful examples in our history.
So a Muslim society has so many expectations from a Muslim lady in different aspects of life, like politically, socially, whatever field men can play their role in their societies, women can also play, but keeping the qualities, their own abilities in mind. So Islam, so many times we have said, Islam never says that the women are not allowed to come and play a role in their society. In the Holy Book, so many verses, they speak about the financial issues of ladies, women, as we recited the beautiful verse of the Holy Quran. Like this, there are so many other riwayat and ayat verses which clearly speak that they have their own independent incoming. They can play a very useful role in their societies. For example, even our fuqaha, they say in some areas, if a Muslim society needs a role, and that role only can women can play. So it is wajib for women to play that role. For example, after you are living in a society where there isn't any female Muslim lady doctor, so it becomes wajib upon all the ladies of that society to become doctor. Yeah, we say wajib kifai. So you can think, you can understand from this verdict that playing a role becomes wajib for a woman.
Yeah.
We have to come out in the society and being within your limits, we should play a role, whatever role our Muslim society needs. So these are the expectations our Muslim society has from a Muslim lady.
And the biggest and the most biggest and the biggest one is to pay attention, especially on children's, you know, her family. Like, she can be very beneficial for the society, but if she's neglecting her children, then what? Then she'll become the source of so many harms in the society,
When she herself comes in the society and plays a role, she's alone. She plays a single role. But she upbrings a whole family, so many great children. They are beneficial. They play a very important role in the society. Means she is playing a team's role.
Generations and generations after generations.
So how important this role is for her. Being a trainer of human beings.
Exactly.
You know, in our modern era, we become, after studying so many years, we become trainer of a certain small area. For example, hardware, trainer of a hardware, or trainer of our bodies.
Yeah.
A specific small trainer.
Exactly.
But look at women's
ability
and role as a human mind trainer, human being trainer.
Therefore, you know, sometimes I've seen on Instagram some young ladies, they have posted that, oh man, you can just carry some weight, but we can carry a human being, you know. We can expect a human being in our tummy. So we are more like stronger than you because you can't carry that. So these are the way of saying that, unfortunately, why we don't understand that our core of our duty, you know, as a Muslim lady, and therefore Muslim society is expecting from us to be present, quality present, you know, and full of charm and, you know, energy at our house. Then if you have extra some energy, then you can cope, you know, if you can cope very easily, you have to be very, very beneficial for your society. Otherwise not, because, you know, some ladies, they are physically a bit weak, so and they are in under pressure that, no, I have to work, I have to earn something. For what? You're earning, for example, gold, and losing your diamonds means your family.
So
that is a very, you know, foolish treatment.
So our Muslim ladies, I think they should know how great they are, how great role they can play. They have to study this. They have to get enough knowledge. Then they can get this confidence. With confidence, they can say, I am a great trainer. Unfortunately, nowadays, when we see in different interviews, when they ask ladies, what is your job? They feel embarrassment and they say, I'm jobless, I'm just a housewife. Whereas Islam proudly says that a housewife's job is the greatest of jobs.
No doubt.
Most noble job you have. We are coming to end of this episode. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. Until next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, former President Donald J. Trump was ordered to fully comply with the Attorney General's subpoena and will be fined $10,000 a day until he does, though the new court ruling may be short-lived. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Jonah Bromwich, Ben Protas, and William Rashbaum. The piece is titled, Judge Holds Trump in Contempt Over Documents in New York Attorney General's Inquiry. A New York State judge on Monday, 25th of April 2022, held former President Donald Trump in contempt of court for failing to comply with a subpoena from the State Attorney General's office, an extraordinary rebuke of the former president that came as that office suggested it might soon file a long-threatened lawsuit against him. The judge, Arthur Engoron, ordered Donald Trump to fully respond to the subpoena from the Attorney General Letitia James, who sought records from the former president about his family business, and assessed a fine of $10,000 per day until he satisfied the court's requirements. Mr. Trump, I know you take your business seriously, and I take mine seriously, said Justice Arthur Engoron, before he held Donald Trump in contempt and banged his gavel. The contempt order amounted to a judicial condemnation of Donald Trump's signature tactic, stonewalling litigation and law enforcement investigations that he has derided as politically motivated, sometimes for years. That practice has helped him emerge from several inquiries largely unscathed, stymieing a legion of prosecutors, regulators and congressional investigators seeking to hold him to account. But New York Attorney General Letitia James has adopted her own aggressive legal strategy that undercut his long effective approach, and she now appears poised to take the next step. After more than 3 years, Letitia James's office said on Monday, 25th of April, that it was nearing the culmination of its inquiry. During the hearing, a lawyer for Ms. James indicated that her office was preparing to file an action against Donald Trump in the near future. That action is likely to be a lawsuit. Letitia James, a Democrat, has previously said that the Trump Organization engaged in fraudulent or misleading practices, but that she needed to collect additional records and testimony before deciding whether to sue Donald Trump or his company. After Ms. James subpoenaed Donald Trump in December, lawyers for the former president argued that they conducted a thorough search for the records being sought by her investigators, and found no new documents to provide. But New York Judge Justice Engoron said on Monday that the lawyers had not provided sufficient detail about how they had conducted the search. The contempt order could be short-lived, if Alina Haba, one of Donald Trump's lawyers, files a sworn statement detailing every step that was taken to locate potential documents, the judge might be satisfied, lawyers close to the case have said. Alina Haba said after the hearing ended that she intended to file such a statement. Ms. Haba also said she intended to appeal the ruling. All documents responsive to the subpoena were produced to the Attorney General months ago, Alina Haba said. This does not even come close to meeting the standard on a motion for contempt. Donald Trump has denied wrongdoing and lashed out at Letitia James, who is black, calling her racist and accusing her of carrying out a politically motivated witch hunt against him. At the court hearing, Justice Arthur Engoron objected to an earlier statement from Donald Trump's lawyers regarding their effort to search for documents, calling it woefully insufficient and boilerplate. It failed, he said, to outline what, who, where, when, and how any search was conducted. The court ruling and Justice Engoron's comments represent a significant victory for Letitia James, whose office is conducting a civil investigation into whether Donald Trump falsely inflated the value of his assets in annual financial statements. In a statement, Letitia James applauded the contempt order, saying, "For years, Donald Trump has tried to evade the law and stop our lawful investigation into him and his company's financial dealings." She added, "Today's court ruling makes clear, no one is above the law." Although Letitia James does not have the authority to file criminal charges, her civil inquiry is running parallel to a criminal investigation led by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, who is examining some of the same conduct. Letitia James's office is participating in that separate investigation as well, which had appeared to be nearing an indictment of Mr. Trump earlier this year, before Alvin Bragg raised concerns about prosecutors' ability to prove their case. Alvin Bragg, also a Democrat, inherited the inquiry from his predecessor after taking office on 1st of January this year. The court ruling on Monday, 25th of April, is a blow for Donald Trump as he continues to battle the Attorney General's investigation. Letitia James has sought to question the former president and two of his children, Ivanka Trump and Donald Trump Jr., as part of her inquiry, and lawyers for the Trump family are seeking to block the questioning. In the autumn of 2020, Letitia James questioned another of Mr. Trump's children, Eric Trump. New York Judge Justice Arthur Engoron also ruled in favor of Letitia James as she sought additional documents from Cushman and Wakefield, a real estate firm that valued several of Donald Trump's properties while also serving as a broker for his company. And in March, Justice Engoron ruled in favor of Letitia James, ordering Donald Trump and his children to be deposed. The Trumps have appealed that ruling. New York Judge Arthur Engoron, a Democrat, was first elected to the New York City Civil Court in 2003. He was elevated to serve as an acting state Supreme Court Justice in 2013, and elected to the state Supreme Court bench in 2015. In New York, the general trial level court is called the Supreme Court. The state's highest court is known as the Court of Appeals. Earlier this month, lawyers from Letitia James's office said that Donald Trump had declined to turn over documents in response to 8 separate requests and called for him to be held in contempt of court and assessed a daily fine of $10,000 as long as he continued not to cooperate. Donald Trump's lawyers have said the requests were grossly overboard and did not adequately describe the requested materials. And Alina Haber said in a document filed with the court last week that Donald Trump did not have any of the documents that Letitia James had requested, and that any such documents, if they existed, would be in the possession of the Trump Organization. She added that Letitia James had filed the motion for contempt without warning, seemingly in an effort to turn this matter into a public spectacle. But lawyers for Letitia James' office said in a court on Monday, 25th of April, that over the course of the investigation, they had received only 10 documents from Donald Trump's files, and that Donald Trump himself had not turned over any documents in response to the December subpoena addressed to him personally. Furthermore, one of Letitia James' lawyers said Alina Haber had not provided an adequate description of the search for relevant documents. The lawyer, Andrew Armour, mentioned a number of relevant files known to his office, including those kept in storage closets and file cabinets at Trump Tower. Kevin Wallace, another lawyer with Letitia James's office, called for those locations to be searched by a third-party organization, Haystack ID, which has overseen the Trump Organization's production of documents in the case. Alina Haber repeated in court that the Trump Organization had searched the locations in question. But New York Judge Arthur Engoron said that that explanation was insufficient, coming from Ms. Haber in court alone. She would have to attest to the fact that search took place and describe it in the sworn statement to be filed with the court. After Justice Arthur Engoron ordered that Donald Trump be held in contempt of court, a lawyer for Mr. Trump's team said that Haystack ID would do a review of Donald Trump's physical files. In a separate case in federal court, Donald Trump sued Letitia James, seeking to halt her civil inquiry and have her removed from the Manhattan District Attorney's criminal investigation. That case is currently ongoing.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.